It took Kristen a little longer before she could manage it, but a moment later, the two children were scrambling back toward Katie and their dad. Kevin saw the swings come to a stop, and a bunch of kids jumped down from their seats, but that wasn't where he focused his attention. Instead, he concentrated on the adults who were crowding the perimeter of the ride. He kept walking, his eyes moving from one woman to the next. Blonde or brunette, it didn't matter. He watched for Aaron's lean figure. From his angle, he couldn't see the faces of the people directly in front of him, so he changed directions. In a few seconds, once the kids reached the exit, everyone would scatter again. He walked quickly. A family stood in front of him, holding tickets, debating where to go next, arguing in confusion. Idiots. He skirted them, straining to see faces near the swings. No skinny women, except for one, a short-haired brunette, standing next to a man with gray hair, his arm around her waist. She was unmistakable. Same long legs, same face, same sinewy arms. Aaron. Chapter 36. Alex and Katie held hands as they walked toward Ivan's with the kids. They'd stored their bicycles near the back door, Katie's regular spot. On the way out, Alex bought some water for Josh and Kristen before they started toward home.
"Good day, guys?"
Alex asked, bending over to unlock the bikes.
"Great day, Daddy,"
Kristen answered, her face red with the heat. Josh wiped his mouth on his arm.
"Can we come back tomorrow?"
"Maybe," Alex fudged.
"Please, I want to ride the swing again."
Finished with the locks, Alex slung the chains over his shoulder.
"We'll see," he said.
An overhang in the back of the restaurant provided some shade, but it was still warm. After seeing how crowded it had been as she'd walked past the windows, Katie was glad she'd taken the day off. Even if she had to work a double shift tomorrow and Monday, it was worth it. It had been a good day, and she'd get to relax and watch a movie with the kids while Alex was away tonight. And then, later, when he got back.
"What?"
Alex said. "Nothing."
"You were staring at me like you were going to eat me up."
"Just drifting off there for a second," she said with a wink. "I think the heat kind of got to me."
"Uh-huh,"
he nodded.
"If I didn't know better."
"I'd like to remind you that there are some young ears tuning in right now, so I'd watch what you say." She kissed him before patting him lightly on the chest. Neither of them noticed the man in the baseball hat and sunglasses watching them from the deck of the neighboring restaurant. Kevin felt dizzy as he watched Aaron and the gray-haired man kiss, seeing the way Aaron flirted with him. He saw her lean down and smile at the little girl, watched as she tousled the hair of the little boy, noticed the gray-haired man pat her on her butt when the children's attention was elsewhere. And Aaron, his wife, was playing along, liking it, encouraging it, cheating on him with her new family as if Kevin and their marriage had never existed at all. They got on their bikes and started pedaling, heading around the side of the building, away from Kevin. Aaron rode beside the gray-haired man. She was wearing shorts and sandals, showing skin, looking sexy for someone else. Kevin followed them. Her hair was blonde and long and flowing. But then he blinked, and it was short and brown again. Pretending she wasn't Aaron and riding bikes with her new family and kissing another man and smiling without a care in the world. It wasn't real, he told himself. It was nothing but a dream, a nightmare. Docked boats wobbled in their slips as they passed. He rounded the corner. They were riding, and he was on foot, but they were moving slowly to allow the little girl to keep up. He was closing the distance, and he was near enough to hear Aaron laugh, sounding happy,
He reached for the Glock in his waistband and pulled it out, then slid it beneath his shirt, keeping it pressed against his skin. He took off the baseball hat and used it to hide the gun from the people around him. His thoughts ricocheted like pachinko balls, bouncing fast, left and right, downward, downward. Aaron lying and cheating and plotting and scheming, running away to find a lover, talking and laughing behind his back, whispering to the gray-haired man, saying dirty things, the man's hands on her breasts, her breaths coming hard, pretending she wasn't married, ignoring all he'd done for her and the sacrifices he'd made, and that he had to scrape the blood from his shoes, and that Coffee and Ramirez were always gossiping about him, and there were flies buzzing on the burgers because she'd run away and he'd had to go to the barbecue alone, and she couldn't tell Bill the captain that he wasn't just one of the guys. And there she was, pedaling easily, her hair short and dyed, as pretty as ever, never thinking about her husband at all. Never caring about him, forgetting him and the marriage so she could have a life with the gray-haired man and pat his chest and kiss him with a dreamy expression on her face. Happy and serene, without a concern in the world, going to carnivals, riding bikes. She probably sang to herself in the shower while he'd been crying and remembering the perfume he'd bought her for Christmas. And none of it mattered because she was selfish and thought she could throw a marriage away like an empty pizza box. He unconsciously picked up his pace. The crowds were slowing them down, and he knew that he could raise the gun and kill her right now. His finger moved to the trigger, and he slipped the safety off, because the Bible says, "Let marriage be held in honor among all, and let the bed be undefiled." But he realized that it meant he had to kill the gray-haired man as well. He could kill him in front of her. All he had to do was pull the trigger, but then hitting moving targets from a distance was almost impossible with a Glock. And there were people everywhere. They would see the gun and scream and shout, and the shot was almost impossible, so he removed his finger from the trigger. "Quit veering toward your sister," the gray-haired man said up ahead, his voice almost lost in the distance. But his words were real, and Kevin imagined the dirty things he whispered to Aaron. He could feel the rage building inside him. Then, all at once, the kids turned the corner, and they were followed by Aaron and the gray-haired man. Kevin stopped, panting and feeling ill. As she'd rounded the corner, her profile had flashed in the bright light, and he thought again that she was beautiful. She'd always reminded him of a delicate flower, so pretty and refined. And he remembered that he'd saved her from being raped by thugs after she left the casino, and how she used to tell him that he made her feel safe, but even that hadn't been enough to keep her from leaving him. Gradually, he began to hear the voices of people walking on either side of him as they passed by, chattering about nothing, going nowhere, but it jolted him into action. He started to jog, trying to reach the spot where they'd turned, feeling like he was going to vomit with every footfall under the blazing sun. His palm felt slick and sweaty around the gun. He reached the corner and peered up the street. No one in sight. But two blocks up, there were barricades blocking the road for the street fair. They must have turned on the street before it. No other choice. He figured they had turned right, the only way to leave the downtown area. He had a choice: chase them on foot and risk being spotted, or run back to the car and try to follow them that way. He tried to think like Aaron, and figured they would go to the house where the gray-haired man lived. Aaron's house was too small, too hot for the four of them, and Aaron would want to go to a pretty house with expensive furniture because she believed she deserved a life like that instead of appreciating the life she had. Pick and choose. Follow on foot or in the car. He stood, blinking and trying to think, but it was hot and confusing. And his head pounded, and all he could think was that Aaron was sleeping with a gray-haired man, and the realization made him sick to his stomach. She probably dressed in lace and danced for him, whispered words that made him hot, begged him to let her please him so she could live in his house with fancy things. She'd become a prostitute, selling her soul for luxuries, selling herself for pearls and caviar. Probably slept in a mansion now, after the gray-haired man took her out for fancy dinners. He felt sick imagining it, hurt and betrayed. The fury helped his thoughts clear, and he realized that he was standing in place as they were getting farther and farther away. His car was blocks away, but he turned and started to run. At the carnival, he pushed through people wildly, ignoring their shouts and protests. "Move! Move!" he shouted, and some people moved and others were shoved aside. He reached a spot clear of the throngs of people, but he was breathing hard and he had to stop to vomit near a fire hydrant. A couple of teenage boys laughed at him, and he felt like shooting them right then and there. But after wiping his mouth, he simply pulled the gun and pointed it at them, and they shut up fast enough. He stumbled forward, feeling the ice pick chip away at his head. Stab and pain, stab and pain. Every damn step it was stab and pain, and Aaron was probably telling the gray-haired man about the sexy things they would do in bed. Telling the gray-haired man about Kevin and laughing, whispering, "Kevin could never please me the way you do," even though it wasn't true. It took forever to get to his car. When he reached it, the sun was baking it like a loaf of bread. Heat spilled out in clouds, and the steering wheel was scalding to the touch. Hellhole. Aaron had chosen to live in a hellhole. He started the car and opened the windows, making a U-turn back toward the carnival and honking at people in the street. Detours again. Barricades. He wanted to blow through them, to blast them into pieces. But even here there were cops, and they would arrest him. Stupid cops. Fat and lazy cops. Barney Fife cops. Idiots. None of them were good detectives, but they had guns and badges. Kevin drove the side streets, trying to zero in on where Aaron was heading. Aaron and her lover. Both of them adulterers. And the Bible says, whoever gazes at a woman with lust has committed adultery in his heart. People everywhere, crossing the street haphazardly, making him stop. He leaned over the steering wheel, straining to see through the windshield, and caught sight of them. Tiny figures in the distance. They were just beyond another barricade, heading toward the road that led to her house. A cop was standing at the corner, another Barney Fife. He surged forward, only to be stopped when a man suddenly appeared at the front of his car, banging on the hood, a redneck with a mullet, skulls on his shirt, tattoos. Fat wife and greasy-looking kids, losers, all of them. "Watch where you're going," the redneck shouted. Kevin mentally shot all of them. Bang, 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 bang. But forced himself not to react because the cop at the corner was eyeballing him. Bang, Kevin thought again. He turned, speeding up, heading through the neighborhood. Turned left and sped up again, turned left again. More barricades up ahead. Kevin made another U-turn, went right, and turned left at the next block. More barricades. He was stuck in a maze, like a rodent undergoing an experiment. The town conspiring against him while Aaron got away. He slammed the car into reverse and backed up. He found the road again and turned, then raced straight to the next intersection. It had to be close now, and he turned left again, saw a line of traffic ahead, moving in the direction he wanted. He turned, muscling his car between a couple of trucks. He wanted to accelerate, but couldn't. Cars and trucks stretched before him, some with Confederate flags on the bumper stickers, others with gun racks on the roof. Rednecks. People in the road made it impossible for the cars to move forward. walking as if they weren't aware that any of the cars existed. People sauntered past, moving faster than he was. Fat people, still eating. Probably eating all day long and slowing the traffic while Aaron got farther and farther away. His car went forward one length and stopped again. Went forward and stopped. Over and over. He felt like screaming. Wanted to pound the wheel, but people were everywhere. If he wasn't careful, someone would say something, and Barney Fife would investigate and remember his out-of-state plates and probably arrest him on the spot, simply because he wasn't a local. Forward and stopping. Over and over. Movement measured in inches until he reached the corner. The traffic had to ease up now, he thought. But it didn't. And up ahead, Aaron and the gray-haired man were gone. There was only a long line of cars and trucks ahead of him, on a road that led nowhere and everywhere at exactly the same time. Chapter 37. A dozen cars were parked in front of the store as Katie trailed the kids up the stairs to the house. Josh and Kristen had whined most of the ride home about how tired their legs were, but Alex ignored it, reminding them periodically that they were getting closer. When that didn't work, he simply commented that he was getting tired too and didn't want to hear any more about it. The complaining ended when they got to the store. Alex let them grab popsicles and Gatorade before they went upstairs, and the burst of cool air as they opened the door was ridiculously refreshing. Alex led Katie to the kitchen, and she watched as he drenched his face and neck at the kitchen sink. In the living room, the kids were already sprawled on the couch, the television on.
"Sorry," he said. "I thought I was about to die about 10 minutes ago."
"You didn't say anything."
"That's because I'm tough," he said, pretending to puff out his chest.
He retrieved 2 glasses from the cupboard and added ice cubes before pouring water from a pitcher he kept in the refrigerator.
"You're a trooper," he added, handing her a glass. "It's like a sauna out there."
"I can't believe how many people are still at the carnival," she said, taking a drink.
"I've always wondered why they don't move up the date to either May or October. But then again, the crowds seem to come no matter what."
She glanced at the clock on the wall. "What time do you have to leave?"
"In an hour or so, but I should be back before 11.
5 hours, she thought. "Do you want me to make the kids anything special for dinner?"
"They like pasta. Kristen likes hers with butter, Josh likes his with marinara, and I've got a bottle of that in the refrigerator. They've been snacking all day, though, so they might not eat much."
"What time do they go to bed?"
"Whenever. It's always before 10, but sometimes it's as early as 8. You'll have to use your best judgment."
She held the cool glass of water against her cheek and glanced around the kitchen. She hadn't spent much time in their home, and now that she was here, she noticed remnants of a woman's touch. Little things. Red stitching on the curtains, china prominently displayed in a cabinet, Bible verses on painted ceramic tiles near the stove. The house was filled with evidence of his life with another woman, but to her surprise, it didn't bother her.
"I'm going to hop into the shower," Alex said. "Will you be okay for a few minutes?"
"Of course," she said. "I can snoop around your kitchen and think about dinner."
"The pasta's in the cupboard over there," he said, pointing. "But listen, when I get out, if you want me to drive you over to your place so you can shower and change, I'd be glad to do it. Or you can shower here. Whatever you want."
She struck a sultry pose. "Is that an invitation?" His eyes widened and then flashed to the kids. "I was kidding," she laughed. "I'll shower after you're gone."
"Do you want to pick up a change of clothes first? If not, you can borrow sweats and a t-shirt. The sweats will be too big for you, but you can adjust the drawstring."
Somehow the idea of wearing his clothes sounded extremely sexy to her. "That's fine," she assured him. "I'm not picky. I'm just watching movies with the kids, remember?"
Alex drained his glass before putting it in the sink. He leaned forward and kissed her, then headed toward the bedroom. Once he was gone, Katie turned toward the kitchen window. She watched the road outside, feeling a nameless anxiety come over her. She'd felt the same way earlier in the morning and assumed it was an aftershock of the argument she'd had with Alex. But now she found herself thinking of the Feldmans again, and about Kevin. She'd thought of him when she was on the Ferris wheel. As she'd scanned the crowd, she knew she hadn't been searching for people from the restaurant, not really. She'd been looking for Kevin, believing for some inexplicable reason that he might be in the crowd, thinking he was there. But that was just her paranoia surfacing again. There was no way he could know where she was, no way to know her identity. It was impossible, she reminded herself. He never would have connected her to the Feldman's daughter. He never even spoke to them. But why, then, had she felt all day like someone was following her, even as they left the carnival? She wasn't psychic and didn't believe in such things, but she did believe in the power of the subconscious mind to put together pieces that the conscious mind might miss. Standing in Alex's kitchen, however, the pieces were still scrambled, without shape or order of any kind, and after watching a dozen cars pass by on the road out front, she finally turned away. It was probably just her old fears raising their ugly head again. She shook her head and thought of Alex in the shower. The thought of joining him made her flush hot with anticipation. And yet, it wasn't quite that simple, even if the kids hadn't been around. Even if Alex thought of her as Katie, Aaron was still married to Kevin. She wished that she were another woman, a woman who could simply move into her lover's arms without hesitation. After all, it was Kevin who had broken all the rules of marriage when he first raised his fists against her. When God looked into her heart, she was pretty sure that he would agree that what she was doing wasn't a sin. Wouldn't he? She sighed. Alex. He was all she could think about. Later was all she could think about. He loved her and wanted her, and she wanted, more than anything, to show him that she felt the same way. She wanted to feel his body against hers. Wanted all of him for as long as he wanted her, forever. Katie forced herself to stop picturing herself with Alex, to stop dreaming about what was to come. She shook her head to clear it and went to the living room, where she took a seat on the couch next to Josh. They were watching a Disney Channel television show she didn't recognize. After a while, she looked up at the clock and noticed that only 10 minutes had gone by. It felt like an hour. Once he finished with his shower, Alex made a sandwich and sat beside her on the couch as he ate. He smelled clean, and his hair was still wet at the ends, clinging to his skin in a way that made her want to trace the line of dampness with her lips. The kids, glued to the screen, ignored them, even after he put the plate on the end table and began to run his finger slowly up and down her thigh. You look beautiful, he whispered into her ear. I look terrible, she countered, trying to ignore the line of fire burning its way up her thigh. I haven't showered yet. When it was time for him to leave, he kissed the kids in the living room. She followed him to the door, and when he kissed her goodbye, he let his hand wander lower, past her waist, his lips soft against hers. Obviously in love with her, obviously wanting her, making sure she knew it. He was driving her crazy, and he seemed to be enjoying it. See you in a bit, he said, pulling back. Drive safely, she whispered. The kids will be fine. When she heard his footsteps descending the steps outside, she leaned against the door, for a long, slow breath. Good Lord, she thought. Good Lord. Vows or not, guilt or not, she decided that even if he wasn't in the mood, she definitely was. She peeked up at the clock again, certain that this would be the longest 5 hours of her life. Chapter 38.
Damn, Kevin kept saying. Damn!
He'd been driving for hours. He'd stopped to buy 4 bottles of vodka at the ABC store. One of them was half gone, and as he drove, he saw 2 of everything, unless he squinted, keeping 1 eye closed. He was searching for bicycles, 4 of them, including 1 with baskets. He might as well have been looking for a specific piece of plankton in the ocean. Up one road and down the next, as the afternoon wound down and dusk settled in. He looked from left to right and back again. He knew where she lived, knew he would eventually find her at home. But in the meantime, the gray-haired man was out there, with Aaron laughing at him, saying, I'm so much better than Kevin, baby. He screamed curses in the car, pounding on the steering wheel. He flipped the safety on the Glock from the off to the on position and back again, imagining Aaron kissing him, his arm around her waist, remembering how happy she'd looked, thinking she had tricked her husband, cheated on him, moaned and murmured beneath her lover while he panted atop her. He could barely see, fighting the blurriness in 1 eye. A car came up behind him on the neighborhood streets, tailgating for a while, then flashing his lights. Kevin slowed the car and pulled over, fingering the gun. He hated rude people. People who thought they owned the road. Bang. Dusk turned the streets into shadowy mazes, making it difficult to see the spindly outlines of bicycles. When he drove past the gravel road for the second time, he decided on impulse to turn around and visit her house again, just in case. He stopped just out of sight of the cottage and got out. A hawk circled overhead, and he heard cicadas humming, but otherwise the place seemed deserted. He started toward the house, but could see already from a distance that there was no bicycle parked out front. No lights on, either. But it wasn't dark yet, so he crept to the back door. Unlocked. Just like before. She wasn't home, and he didn't think she'd been home since he'd been here earlier. The house was sweltering, all the windows shut tight. She would have opened the windows, he felt sure. Would have had a glass of water, might have taken a shower. Nothing. He left through the back door, staring at the neighboring house. A dump. Probably deserted. Good. But the fact that Aaron wasn't home meant she was with the gray-haired man, had gone to his house. Cheating. Pretending she wasn't married. Forgetting the home that Kevin had bought for her. His head throbbed in time with his heartbeats. A knife going in and out. Stab, stab, stab. It was hard to focus as he pulled the door closed behind him. Mercy of all mercies, it was cooler outside. She lived in a sweat box, sweated with a gray-haired man. They were sweating together now somewhere, writhing in sheets, bodies intertwined. Coffee and Ramirez were laughing about that, slapping their thighs, having a good old time at his expense.
I wonder if I could do it too, Coffee was saying to Ramirez. Don't you know? Ramirez answered back. She let half the precinct do it while Kevin was working. Everyone knows about it.
Bill waving from his office, holding suspension papers.
I did it too, every Tuesday for a year. She's wild in bed, says the dirtiest things.
He stumbled back to his car, his finger on the gun. Bastards, all of them. Hated them. Imagined walking into the precinct and unloading the Glock, emptying the clip, showing them, showing all of them. Aaron, too. He stopped and bent over, vomiting onto the side of the road, stomach cramping, a clawing in his gut like a rodent was trapped inside him. Puked again, and then dry heaves, and the world spun when he tried to stand. The car was close, and he staggered to it, grabbed the vodka and drank and tried to think like Aaron. But then he was at the barbecue, holding a burger covered in flies, and everyone was pointing and laughing at him. Back to the car. Bitch had to be somewhere. She'd watch gray hair die, watch them all die, burn in hell, burn and burn, all of them. Carefully, he climbed in and started the car. He backed into a tree as he was trying to turn around, and then, cursing, tore out on the gravel, spinning rocks. Night would soon be falling. She came in this direction, had to be down this way. Little kids couldn't ride far, 3 or 4 miles, maybe 5. He'd been down every road this way, looked at every house. No bicycles. They could be in the garage, could be parked in fenced yards. He'd wait, and she'd come home sometime. Tonight, tomorrow, tomorrow night. He'd stick the gun in her mouth, aim it at her breasts. "Tell me who he is," he'd say. "I just want to talk to him." He'd find gray hair and show him what happened to men who slept with other men's wives. He felt like he had been weeks without sleep, weeks without food. He couldn't understand why it was dark, and he wondered when that happened. Couldn't remember when he got here exactly. He remembered seeing Aaron, remembered trying to follow her and driving, but he wasn't even sure where he was. A store loomed on the right, looking like a house with a porch out front. "Gas, food," the sign said. He remembered that from earlier, but how long ago he couldn't say. He slowed the car involuntarily. He needed food, needed to sleep, had to find a place to stay the night. His stomach lurched. He grabbed the bottle and tilted the bottom up, feeling the burn in his throat, soothing him. But as soon as he lowered the bottle, his stomach heaved again. He pulled into the lot, fighting to keep the liquor down, his mouth watering, running out of time. He skidded to a stop alongside the store and jumped out, ran to the front of his car and heaved into the darkness. His body shivered, his legs wobbled, his stomach coming up, his liver, all of it. Somehow, he was still holding the bottle, hadn't put it down. He breathed hard in and out and drank, using it to rinse his mouth, swallowing it, finishing another bottle. And there, like an image from a dream, in the darkened shadows behind the house, he saw 4 bicycles parked side by side. Chapter 39. Katie had the kids take a bath before getting them into their pajamas. Afterward, she showered, lingering under the spray and enjoying the luxurious feeling of shampoo and soap rinsing the salt from her body after a day in the sun. She made the kids their pasta, and after dinner they sorted through the collection of DVDs, trying to find one that both kids wanted to watch, until they finally agreed on Finding Nemo. She sat between Josh and Kristen on the couch, a bowl of popcorn in her lap, their little hands reaching in automatically from either direction. She wore a comfy pair of sweats that Alex had laid out and a worn Carolina Panthers jersey, tucking her legs up under her as they watched the movie, utterly at ease for the first time that day. Outside, the heavens bloomed like fireworks, displaying vibrant rainbow colors that faded to pastel washes before finally giving way to bluish gray and then indigo skies. Stars began to flicker as the last shimmering waves of heat rose from the earth. Kristen had begun to yawn as the movie progressed, but every time Dory appeared on screen, she managed to chirp, "She's my favorite, but I can't remember why." On the other side of her, Josh was struggling to stay awake. When the movie ended and Katie leaned forward to turn it off, Josh raised his head and let it fall to the couch. He was too big for her to carry, so she nudged his shoulder, telling him it was time for bed. He grunted and whined before sitting up. He yawned and rose to his feet and, with Katie by his side, staggered to the bedroom. He crawled into bed without complaint, and she kissed him goodnight. Unsure whether he needed a nightlight, she kept the light in the hallway on, but closed the door partway.
Kristen was next. She asked Katie to lie beside her for a few minutes, and Katie did, staring at the ceiling, feeling the heat of the day beginning to take its toll. Kristen fell asleep within minutes, and Katie had to force herself to stay awake before tiptoeing out of the room. Afterward, she cleaned up the remnants of their dinner and emptied the bowl of popcorn. As she glanced around the living room, she noticed evidence of the kids everywhere. A stack of puzzles on a bookshelf, a basket of toys in the corner, comfortable leather couches that were gloriously spill-proof. She studied the knick-knacks scattered about, an old-fashioned clock that had to be wound daily, an ancient set of encyclopedias on a shelf near the recliner, a crystal vase on the table near the windowsill. On the walls hung framed black-and-white architectural photographs of decaying tobacco barns. They were quintessentially Southern, and she remembered seeing many of these rustic scenes on her journey through North Carolina. There were also signs of the chaotic life Alex led, a red stain on the runner in front of the couch, gouges in the wood floor, dust on the baseboards. But as she surveyed the house, she couldn't help smiling, because those things, too, seemed to reflect who Alex was. He was a widowed father, doing his best to raise two kids and keep a tidy, if imperfect, house. The house was a snapshot of his life, and she liked its easy, comfortable feel. She turned out the lights and collapsed on the couch. She picked up the remote and surfed TV channels, trying to find something interesting but not too demanding. It was coming up on 10 o'clock, she noted, an hour to go. She lay back on the couch and started watching a show on the Discovery Channel, something about volcanoes. She noticed a glare on the screen and stretched to turn off the lamp on the end table, darkening the room. She leaned back again. Better. She watched for a few minutes, barely aware that every time she blinked, her eyes stayed closed a fraction longer. Her breath slowed, and she began to melt into the cushions. Images began to float through her mind, disjointed at first. Thoughts of the carnival rides, the view from the Ferris wheel. People standing in random clusters, young and old, teens and couples, families. And somewhere in the distance, a man in a baseball hat and sunglasses, weaving among the crowd, moving with purpose before she lost sight of him again. Something she'd recognized. The walk, the jut of his jaw, the way he swung his arms. She was drifting now, relaxing and remembering, the images beginning to blur, the sound of the television fading, the room growing darker, quieter. She drifted further, her mind flashing back again and again to the view from the Ferris wheel, and of course, to the man she'd seen. A man who'd been moving like a hunter through the brush in search of game. Chapter 40. Kevin stared up at the windows, nursing his half-empty bottle of vodka, his third of the night. No one gave him a second glance. He was standing on the dock at the rear of the house. He'd changed into a black long-sleeved shirt and dark jeans. Only his face was visible, but he stood in the shade of a cypress tree, hidden behind the trunk, watching the windows, watching the lights, watching for Aaron. Nothing happened for a long while. He drank, working on finishing the bottle. People came through the store every few minutes, often using their credit cards to buy gas at the pump. Busy, busy, even out here, in the middle of nowhere. He moved around to the side of the store, gazing up at the windows. He recognized the flickering blue glow of a television. The four of them, watching TV, acting like a happy family. Or maybe the kids were already in bed, tired from the carnival, tired from the bike ride. Maybe it was just Aaron and the gray-haired man snuggling on the couch, kissing and touching each other while Meg Ryan or Julia Roberts fell in love on the screen.
Everything hurt, and he was tired, and his stomach kept churning. He could have walked up the stairs and kicked the door in, could have killed them half a dozen times already, and he wanted to get it over with, but there were people in the store, cars in the lot. He'd pushed his own car forward with the engine off to a spot beneath a tree at the rear of the store, out of sight from passing cars. He wanted to aim the Glock and pull the trigger, wanted to watch them die, but he also wanted to lie down and go to sleep because he'd never been more tired in his life, and when he woke up, he wanted to find Erin beside him and think to himself that she had never left him. Later, he spotted her profile at the window, saw her smiling as she turned away, and knew she was thinking about the gray-haired man, thinking about sex. And the Bible says those who gave themselves over to fornication and strange flesh are set forth for an example and suffering the vengeance of eternal fire. He was an angel of the Lord. Erin had sinned, and the Bible says she shall be tormented with fire and brimstone in the presence of holy angels. In the Bible, there was always fire, because it purified and condemned, and he understood that. Fire was powerful, the weapon of angels. He finished the bottle of vodka and kicked it under the bushes. A car pulled up to the gasoline pumps, and a man stepped out. He slid his credit card in and began to pump gas. The sign near the pump informed people it was illegal to smoke because gasoline was flammable. Inside the store, there was lighter fluid for use with charcoal. He remembered the man in line ahead of him earlier, holding a can of it. Fire. Alex shifted and adjusted his hands on the wheel, trying to get comfortable. Joyce and her daughter were in the back seat and hadn't stopped talking from the moment they'd gotten in the car. The clock on the dashboard showed it was getting late. The kids were either in bed or soon would be, which sounded good right now. On the drive back, he'd had a bottle of water, but he was still thirsty and debated whether to stop again. He was sure that neither Joyce nor her daughter would mind, but he didn't want to stop. He just wanted to get home. As he drove, he felt his mind drifting. He thought about Josh and Kristen, about Katie, and he sifted through memories of Carly. He tried to imagine what Carly would say about Katie, and whether Carly would have wanted him to give the letter to her. He remembered the day he'd seen Katie helping Kristen with her doll, and recalled how beautiful she had looked on the night she'd made him dinner. The knowledge that she was at his house waiting for him made him want to floor the accelerator. On the other side of the highway, distant pinpricks of light appeared on the horizon, slowly separating and growing larger, forming headlamps of oncoming cars. They grew brighter until they flashed past. In the rearview mirror, red lights receded into the distance. Heat lightning crackled to the south, making the sky blink like a slideshow. Off to the right was a farmhouse, lights on downstairs. He passed a truck with Virginia plates and rolled his shoulders, trying to shake off the fatigue he felt. He passed the sign indicating the number of miles to Wilmington and sighed. He still had a ways to go. Katie's eyelids fluttered as she dreamed, her subconscious working overtime, bits and pieces, fragments, trying to connect with each other. The dream ended, and a few minutes later, she tucked her knees up and shifted onto her side, almost waking. Her breathing began to slow again. At 10 o'clock, the lot was nearly empty. It was just before closing time, and Kevin walked around to the front of the store, squinting at the light coming through the front door. He pushed the door open and heard a bell jingle. At the register was a man in an apron. Kevin vaguely recognized him, but couldn't place him. He was wearing a white apron, the name Roger stenciled on the right. Kevin walked past the register, trying not to slur his words.
I ran out of gas up the road.
Gas cans are along the far wall, Roger answered, without looking up.
When he finally did, he blinked.
You okay?
Just tired, Kevin said from the aisle, trying not to draw attention to himself, but knowing the man was watching. The Glock was in his waistband, and all Roger had to do was mind his own business. At the far wall, Kevin saw 3 5-gallon plastic cans and reached for 2 of them. He brought them to the register and put money on the counter.
"I'll pay after I fill them," he said.
Outside, he pumped the gas into the can, watching the numbers roll past. He filled the second and went back inside. Roger was staring at him, hesitating to make change.
"That's a lot of gas to carry."
"Aaron needs it."
"Who's Aaron?"
Kevin blinked.
"Can I buy the damn gas or not?"
"You sure you're okay to drive?"
"I've been sick," Kevin muttered. "Puking all day."
He wasn't sure whether Roger believed him, but after a moment, Roger took the money and made change. Kevin had left the cans near the gas pumps and went to pick them up. It was like lifting cans of lead. He strained, his stomach churning, pulsating pain between his ears. He started up the road, leaving behind the lights of the store. In the darkness, he set the cans down in the tall grass just off the road. After that, he circled back behind the store, waiting for Roger to close up, waiting for the lights to go out, waiting for everyone to fall asleep upstairs. He retrieved another bottle of vodka from the car and took a sip. In Wilmington, Alex began to perk up, knowing he was getting close. It wouldn't be long now, maybe half an hour before he reached Southport. It would take another few minutes to drop off Joyce and her daughter, but then he would be home. He wondered if he would find Katie waiting up for him in the living room, or whether, as she'd teased, he would find her in his bed. It was the kind of thing that Carly used to say. They might have been talking about the business or whether her parents were enjoying Florida, when out of the blue, she'd announce that she was bored and ask him whether he wanted to go to the bedroom and fool around. He stared at the clock. 10:15, and Katie was waiting. On the side of the road, Alex saw 6 deer frozen on the grass, their eyes reflecting the headlights, glowing like something unnatural. Haunted. Kevin watched the fluorescent lights above the gas pumps flicker off. Lights in the store went out next. From his hidden vantage point, he watched Roger locking the door. He tugged on it, making sure it was secure before turning away. He walked to a brown pickup truck parked on the far side of the gravel lot and got in. The engine started with a whine and squeak, a loose fan belt. Roger revved the engine, turned on the headlights, then put the truck in gear. He turned onto the main road, heading toward downtown. Kevin waited 5 minutes, making sure Roger wouldn't turn around and come back. The road in front of the store was quiet now, no cars or trucks coming from either direction. He jogged over to the bushes where he'd hidden the cans, checked the road again, and then carried one of them to the back of the store. He did the same with a 2nd can, setting them next to a couple of metal garbage cans filled with rotting food. The stench was overwhelming. Upstairs, the TV continued to bathe one of the windows in blue light. There were no other lights, and he knew they were naked. He felt the rage well up inside him. Now, he thought, it was time. When he reached for the gas cans, he saw 4 of them. He closed one eye, and it was back to 2. He stumbled as he took a step and jerked forward, off balance, swaying as he tried to grab the corner of the wall to keep from falling. He missed and fell, landing hard, his head hitting the gravel. Sparks and stars, shooting pains. It was hard to breathe. Tried to stand up and fell again. He rolled over onto his back, staring up at the stars. He wasn't drunk, because he never got drunk, but something was wrong. Twinkling lights were whirling round and round, caught in an accelerating tornado. He squeezed his eyes shut, but the spinning got worse. He rolled to his side and vomited onto the gravel. Someone must have slipped him drugs because he'd barely had anything to drink all day, and he'd never been sick like this. He reached out blindly for the garbage can. He grabbed the lid and tried to use it for balance, but he pulled too hard. The lid clattered off and a bag of garbage spilled out, making an unholy racket. Upstairs, Katie flinched at the sound of something crashing. She was lost in her dream, and it took a moment for her eyes to flutter open. Groggy, she listened but wasn't sure why, wasn't sure whether she'd dreamed the sound or not. But there was nothing. She leaned back, giving way to sleep again, and the dream picked up from where it left off. She was at the carnival, on the Ferris wheel, but it was no longer Kristen sitting beside her. It was Joe. Kevin was finally able to struggle to his feet and stay upright. He couldn't figure out what was happening to him, why he couldn't keep his balance. He concentrated on catching his breath, in and out, in and out. He spotted the cans of gas and stepped toward them, almost falling again. But he didn't fall. He lifted a can, then staggered toward the stairs at the back of the house. He reached out for the railing and missed it, then tried again. Got it. He lugged the can of gas up the stairs toward the door, a Sherpa in the Himalayas. He finally reached the landing at the top, panting, and bent over to remove the cap. His head filled with blood, making him swoon, but he used the gas can to keep from falling. It took a while before he could get the cap off because it kept slipping between his fingers. Once open, he picked up the can and doused the landing, splashing its contents against the door. With every heave, the can got lighter, gas spilling out in arcs, drenching the wall, getting easier now. He splashed left and right, trying to coat either side of the building. He started back down the stairs, splashing left and right. The fumes made him sick, but he kept going. There wasn't much gas left in the can when he reached the bottom, and he rested at ground level. He was breathing hard, and the fumes were making him feel sick again, but he began moving again, with purpose now. Determination. He tossed the empty can aside and reached for the other. He couldn't douse the upper reaches of the walls, but he did what he could. He splashed one side and then circled around the back to the other side. Above him, the window still flickered with light from the television, but all was quiet. He drained the can on the other side of the building and had nothing left for the front. He scanned the road. No cars were coming from either direction. Upstairs, Aaron and the gray-haired man were naked and laughing at him. And Aaron ran away, and he almost found her in Philadelphia, but back then she was calling herself Erica, not Aaron, and now she pretended her name was Katie. He stood in front of the store, thinking about the windows. Maybe they were alarmed, and maybe not. He didn't care. He needed lighter fluid, motor oil, turpentine, anything that would burn. But once he broke the window, he wouldn't have much time. He shattered the window with his elbow, but heard no alarm. Pulling out pieces of glass, he barely felt his fingers getting cut and beginning to bleed. More chunks, the window coming apart in sections. He thought the opening was big enough for him to climb inside, but his arm caught on a jagged shard, deep. He pulled, tearing flesh, but he couldn't stop now. Blood flowed from his arm, dripping and mingling with the cuts on his fingers. The coolers along the back wall were still illuminated, and he walked the aisles, wondering idly if Cheerios would burn, if Twinkies would burn. DVDs. He located the charcoal and the lighter fluid. Only two cans, not much. Not enough. He blinked, looking around for something else. He spotted the grill in the rear of the store. Natural gas. Propane. He approached the grill area, lifted the divider, and stood facing the grill itself. He turned a burner on, then another. There had to be a valve somewhere, but he didn't know where to find it, and he didn't have time because someone might be coming, and Coffee and Ramirez were talking about him, laughing and asking whether he'd had the crab cakes in Provincetown. Roger's apron hung on a rack, and he tossed it onto the flame. He opened the can of lighter fluid he was holding and sprayed it on the walls of the grill. The can was slippery with blood, and he wondered where the blood had come from. He hopped up onto the counter and squirted some lighter fluid on the ceiling and got down again. He ran a trail of fluid along the front of the store, noticing that the apron had begun to burn in earnest. He emptied the can and tossed it aside. Opening the second can, he squirted more fluid at the ceiling. The flames from the apron began leaping toward the walls and the ceiling. He went to the register and searched for a lighter and found a bunch of them in a plastic bin near the cigarettes. He squirted lighter fluid on the register and on the little table behind him. The can was empty now, too, and he stumbled toward the window he'd broken earlier. He climbed out, stepping on broken glass, hearing it crack and pop. Standing by the side of the house, he flicked the lighter and held it against the gas-soaked wall, watching as the wood caught fire. At the back of the house, he touched the flame to the stairs, and the flames rose quickly, shooting up to the door and spreading to the roof. Next came the far side. Fire blossomed everywhere, the exterior rippling with flame, and Aaron was a sinner, and her lover was a sinner, and the Bible says they will suffer the punishment of eternal destruction. He stood back, watching the fire start to consume the building, wiping his face, leaving trails of blood. In the glowing orange light, he looked like a monster. In her dream, Jo wasn't smiling as she sat beside Katie on the Ferris wheel. She seemed to be searching the crowd below, a frown of concentration on her face. "There," she said, pointing. "Over there. Do you see him? What are you doing here? Where's Kristen?" "She's sleeping. But you have to remember now." Katie looked, but there were so many people, so much movement. "Where?" she asked. "I don't see anything."
"He's here," Jo said.
"Who?"
"You know."
In her dream, the Ferris wheel lurched to a stop. The sound was loud, like the shattering of glass, and it seemed to signal a change. The carnival's colors began to fade, the scene below dissolving into cloud banks that hadn't been there a moment before. As if the world were slowly being erased, and then everything suddenly dimmed. She was surrounded by impenetrable darkness, broken only by an odd flickering at the periphery of her vision, and the sound of someone talking. Katie heard Joe's voice again, almost a whisper.
"Can you smell it?"
Katie sniffed, still lost in the haze. Her eyes fluttered open, stinging for some reason, as she tried to clear her sight. The television was still on, and she realized she must have fallen asleep. The dream was already fading away, but she heard Joe's words clearly in her head.
"Can you smell it?"
Katie took a deep breath as she pushed herself to a sitting position and immediately started coughing. It took only an instant to realize that the room was filled with smoke. She bolted off the couch. Smoke meant fire, and now she could see the flames outside the window, dancing and twisting orange. The door was on fire, smoke billowing from the kitchen in thick clouds. She heard roaring, a sound like a train, heard cracks and pops and splintering, her mind taking it in at once. "Oh my God, the kids!" She ran toward the hallway, panicked at the sight of heavy smoke billowing from both rooms. Josh's room was closest, and she rushed in, waving her arms against the stinging black fog. She reached the bed and grabbed Josh's arm, dragging him up.
"Josh, get up! The house is on fire! We've got to get out!"
He was about to whine, but she pulled him up, cutting him off.
"Come on!"
she screamed. He immediately began to cough, doubled over as she dragged him out. The hallway was an impenetrable wall of smoke, but she rushed forward nonetheless, pulling Josh behind her. Groping, she found the door jamb to Kristen's room across the hall. It wasn't as bad as Josh's room, but she could feel the enormous heat building behind them. Josh continued to cough and wail, struggling to keep up, and she knew better than to let go. She raced to Kristen's bedside and shook her, pulling her out of bed with her other hand. The roaring of the fire was so loud, she could barely hear the sound of her own voice. Half carrying, half dragging the kids back out into the hallway, she saw an orange glow, barely visible through the smoke, where the entrance to the hallway was. The wall crawled with fire, flames on the ceiling moving toward them. She didn't have time to think, only had time to react. She turned and pushed the kids back down the hallway toward the master bedroom, where the smoke was less thick. She rushed into the room, flicking on the light, still working. Alex's bed stood against one wall, a chest of drawers against another. Straight ahead was a rocking chair and windows, thankfully untouched as yet by fire. She slammed the door behind her. Racked by coughing spasms, she stumbled forward, dragging Josh and Kristen. Both of them were wailing between hoarse bouts of coughing. She tried to free herself to raise the bedroom window, but Kristen and Josh clung to her. "I need to open the window," she screamed, shaking herself free. "This is the only way out." In their panic, they didn't understand, but Katie didn't have time to explain. Frantically, she tore at the old-fashioned window lock and tried to heave the heavy pane up. It wouldn't budge. Peering closer, Katie realized that the frame had been painted shut, probably years ago. She didn't know what to do, but the sight of the two children staring at her in terror cleared her head. She looked around, frantic, finally seizing the rocking chair. It was heavy, but somehow she lifted it above her shoulder and heaved it at the window with all her might. It cracked, but didn't break. She tried again, sobbing through a last burst of adrenaline and fear, and this time the rocking chair went flying out, crashing onto the overhang below. Moving fast, Katie raced to the bed and tore off the comforter. She bundled it around Josh and Kristen and began pushing them toward the window. There was a loud splintering sound behind her as a part of the wall burst into flame, tendrils licking the ceiling. Katie turned in panic, pausing long enough to notice the portrait that hung on the wall. She stared at it, already knowing it was of Alex's wife because there was no one else it could be. She blinked, thinking it was an illusion, a distortion created by the smoke and fear. She took an involuntary step toward the eerily familiar face when she heard a roar above her as the ceiling started to give way. Whirling around, she pushed through the window, holding the kids in the circle of her arms and praying that the comforter would protect them from glass shards. They seemed to hang in the air for an eternity, Katie twisting as they fell so that the kids would land on top of her. She hit the overhang on her back with a whump. It wasn't far, maybe 4 or 5 feet, but the impact left her breathless before pain rolled over her in waves. Josh and Kristen were hiccuping in fear, wailing and coughing, but they were alive. She blinked, trying not to pass out, sure she'd broken her back. But she hadn't. She moved one leg, then the other. She shook her head to clear her vision. Josh and Kristen were struggling on top of her, trying to get free of the comforter. Above her, tongues of flame began to flare from the broken bedroom window. Flames were everywhere now, all over the house, and she knew they only had seconds to live unless she somehow summoned the strength to move. On his way back from Joyce's house, Alex noticed the sky glowing orange just above the blackened tree line on the outskirts of town. He hadn't seen that as they drove into town and navigated the streets to Joyce's home. Now, however, he frowned as he turned in that direction. Something in his gut told him that danger lay ahead, and he debated only an instant before pressing down on the accelerator. Josh and Kristen were already sitting up as Katie rolled over. The ground was perhaps a 10-foot drop from the overhang, but she had to risk it. They were running out of time. Josh continued to sob, but didn't protest as Katie quickly explained what was going to happen next. She seized his arms, trying to keep her voice steady. "I'm going to lower you as far as I can, but then you're going to have to jump." He nodded, seemingly in shock, and she quickly scooted toward the edge, dragging Josh with her. He moved to the edge and she grabbed his hand. The overhang was shaking now, fire climbing up both support columns. Josh climbed over, legs first, holding on, Katie sliding on her belly toward the edge, lowering him. God, the agony in her arms. 4 feet. No more, she told herself. He wouldn't fall far, and he would land on his feet. She let go as the roof shuddered. Kristen crawled toward her, trembling.
Okay, baby, your turn, Katie urged. Give me your hand.
She did the same thing with Kristen, holding her breath as she let go. A moment later, both of them were on their feet, staring up at her. They were waiting for her.
Run! She screamed. Move back!
Her words were swallowed by another coughing spasm, and she knew she had to move. She grabbed the edge of the overhang and swung one leg off, then the other. She dangled for only an instant before her grip weakened. She hit the ground and felt her knees buckle before she rolled to a stop in front of the store entrance. Her legs screamed with pain, but she had to get the kids to safety. She scrambled toward them, seizing their hands and beginning to drag them away. Fire was dancing, leaping, spurting toward the sky. Nearby trees caught fire, their upper branches sparking like firecrackers. There was a sharp clap, loud enough to make her ears ring. She chanced a peek over her shoulder